Reset your system clock to 1993, pull out that laser gun and blast open an aquifer, and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1, the Amiga, Mac, and MS-DOS. Welcome back, I'm your host SuperVGA, and in today's episode we are descending into the deepest depths of the development history of Another World. Notice anything different? Yes, I've stayed true to my word, and we are on track for the third part of many, many parts. Unfortunately, I was hoping that I could squeeze this into maybe three or four parts altogether. That's not even remotely going to happen. But still, this is fun. This is great. This just means a project that I thought might take 10 to 15 hours of research took 30 to 50 hours. So, community memory. I'm happy to say that we got another great letter from our friend Edgar in the Netherlands. Edgar writes, "Hi again, VGA. I'm writing to you in response to the wonderful episode 2 on Microman. This is the CD-ROM magazines and stores episode. If you're interested, this episode did flash me back to the early 90s and reminded me of the golden age of PC magazines when I was young. I only got an issue very occasionally, though, because of my relatively small allowance in comparison to some other kids in my class. However, sometimes I got an extra copy from my parents for good behavior. Each magazine kept me very busy. They obviously knew that, since I had to read every page cover to cover. Basically, trying to understand and know, even memorize everything there was to it. The issues were often the UK edition of PC Pro or the German PC Welt. It's W-E-L-T. I assume that's Welt, but I could be 1,000% wrong. Please write to me if you are a German speaker. Sorry about that. The latter magazine really took some effort to read at my age. I recall words like, oh boy, Speicher, possibly, and Festplatte, memory and hard disk. Okay, Festplatte, hard disk. Okay, kind of makes sense. A few years later, at 15 years old, I got my first job at this very magazine store. Actually, to be fully honest, it was my second job right after I left working for 3 months at the newly opened Applebee's at the local mall, only the third to be opened in the country. The interesting part of this magazine store was that I was doing live CD-ROM demos trying to boost sales. Showing and explaining what you could do with certain programs and utilities did turn out to make a difference, to my recollection at least. The best-selling box software might have been Norton or McAfee Antivirus or perhaps Quarterdeck CleanSweep for uninstalling software. The Dutch game A2 Racer also sold better than expected. Got a favor gameplay over graphics, I guess. It occurred to me that most bookstore visitors knew so little about software. Perhaps it just makes sense because not many people were familiar with the internet and the web back then. I honestly loved assisting customers on their often new adventure into the digital world. And of course, for me, playing those early games I didn't have at home when the store was quiet was a blast. I think I'm going to look up those magazines, which are still in my old room at my dad's. I'm curious to see what's actually on those CD-ROMs. My guess is a lot of shareware and demos to lure you into a buy. Signing off on a Friday night, kind regards and have a nice weekend, Edgar. P.S. I do agree on the often too lengthy tutorial in games these days, perhaps of the rather difficult controls with Red Dead Redemption and Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order on the PS4. I would rather dive in and explore. P.S. number two. I, too, played Another World, aka Out of This World. It had that mysterious feeling about it, perhaps because of the spooky intro or it being able to play crackling sampled wave sound effects through a PC speaker. It is a French make, isn't it? Today, I stumbled upon a fun new episode of 20,000 Hertz podcast on the startup sound of Windows over the years. Do you remember? Well, of course, you can still run it on actual hardware. Indeed, I can. Edgar, you weren't joking that you were taking your time working through the episodes. Well, I'm so glad you're able to sneak off a few minutes of the show in before bed. Boy, can I remember ever having a pitiful allowance. I remember it being around $5 a week, or that would translate in 1993 dollars to about 8 Netherland guilders. And trust me, that didn't go very far. In fact, it was the midst of COVID-19 that somebody locally was actually giving away 6 episodes of CD-ROM Today magazine. That's the one I'm sure that I've mentioned many, many, many times. I'm guessing people are kind of getting sick about hearing CD-ROM Today. That would be in the Microman episode, I'm sure I talked about it. Well, I can't imagine what kind of insane person just gives away such a quality publication in 2021. But yes, we live in an insane world, and I'm sure that the pandemic had something to do with this person losing their mind, giving away such treasures. Anyway, when I got home with these 6 issues, I noticed that the price on the cover was $7.95 USD or CAD. That's US dollars or Canadian dollars, which I can't believe they were selling at par between both countries, because our dollar was not equivalent to each other in those days, or about 12 Netherland guilders in 93-94. Considering that most grocery store till magazines were a couple of dollars, this was incredibly expensive at the time. $8 for a magazine. Trying to sell your parents on buying you an $8 magazine, or, you know, a 12 guilder magazine in 1993, 94, 95 is madness. But occasionally, it would take me about 2 weeks to save up enough money to do it, you know, about $10. I'd bring home a new copy of the magazine once a month. This also meant, though, there was a drawback to this, because if I blew all of my money on CD-ROM Today issues, this also meant I couldn't save up for big box games. So yeah, there's definitely kind of a trade-off between those two. Edgar, you sure gave me a chuckle hearing the name Quarterdeck Clean Sweep. I sure do remember that utility, because they came up with a Windows 95 compatible edition called Clean Sweep 95 that I pirated back in the day and installed on every computer I had access to. Now, I think we're past our, what is the word for that? When you're no longer allowed to charge somebody for a crime. Back in 1995, I worked for the first internet service provider in the Canada's north. And our store, even though it was technically just an ISP, was also a computer store, because we sold Gateway 2000 computers. I assume I've mentioned this more than a few times on the episodes, but I've kind of lost track of which stories I've told, which stories I haven't. So we had the back of the store, which was where we did all of the PC setup, PC repairs, PC installation for the Gateway 2046s. But we also had a front store where our boss kept boxed software. You have to keep in mind that the nearest city from this little village that this ISP was located in was large city, was about a 15-hour drive. There is a 0.5% chance any human being was going to show up inside of our store and buy a physical boxed copy of software off of our shelf. And so anyway, I'm rationalizing this specifically because we had a copy of Quarterdeck Clean Sweep 95 sitting on that shelf for about a year. And I worked at this place in the summers. Then I'd go back to high school, 15 hours away in my hometown. And then I'd come back to this ISP in the next following summer. And sure enough, all of the same software was still sitting on the shelf because no one bought it. So I used to, and I feel bad about this now, because this wasn't my stuff I was pirating, but I used to pop open those software boxes, take out the disks, and then make backup copies of them, which would give me access to a pretty sweet little program along with its serial number, which I would also use and write down. So Quarterdeck Clean Sweep, along with, there was some kind of CAD program that I had also used. It was Micro something. It wasn't MicroCAD. It was another kind of specialty CAD program. I don't even think I used it once, but I just really, really liked having pirated software on disks. So anyway, to my old boss, I am so sorry I did that. I was 15 years old, very foolish, and I did not learn how to properly pirate software by copying it from other software pirates until years later. Anyway, back to you, Edgar, sorry. I love that you ended up working at the same magazine store that you yourself bought cover disc mags from. I could have only dreamt of doing that as a teenager. I imagine this meant that you also got an employee discount on magazines. Is that possible? That can't have been good for your weekly salary, if that's true. Write back. I'd love to know. Now, did your store both carry Windows and Mac user-oriented magazines, or was it kind of devoted to one user over the other? Because I know that some parts of Europe had a very strong Mac presence. For instance, France still has a very large and devoted Apple Newton community, which I was in contact with recently. Magazines like Mac Addict and Mac User were very, very popular, at least amongst Mac owners, Apple users in North America. I know that one of these magazines had a really well-liked cover disc. Now, I didn't have a Mac back in those days, so I didn't have Mac Addict or Mac User, and I really regret that because I think it was the Mac Addict magazine that came with a cover disc, and I heard they were fabulous, putting out a lot of HyperCard stuff that I didn't get access to until much later in life. On the subject of cover discs, I regret only finding out about PC gamers' cover discs later in life too. They often had actual full or registered versions of games, not even demos, like Betrayal at Krondor, Ultima 4, Ultima Underworld, all appeared on cover discs in the late 90s. There was this one famous classic issue that I love to buy at some point that had a ton of games, including like the registered versions of Commander Keen and stuff on it. Now, these weren't exactly new games at the time. They were already almost 5, 6, 7 years old, but I would love to have, would have loved to have those games in my teenage years. So please, Edgar, be sure to write in if you managed to track down those old magazines at your dad's place. We'd love to hear how you found them. It's a funny coincidence that you brought up Another World, as I was in the middle of writing these episodes when I received your email, so it looks like we're on the same wavelength here. No doubt you won't catch up to this episode for another year or two, but if and when you do, I'm sure you'll be pleasantly surprised, Edgar. Yours truly, VGA. Oh, and we also got our first email from Chris. Chris writes, "This is the very first time I write to your show, or any show for that matter, so apologies if this should sound a bit clunky. Having had an Amiga 600 in the 90s as a little kid, at first, then we eventually got a 1200, but it wasn't until later, I am very predictably quite fond of Another World. I too remember replaying the intro over and over, even just to get that little eye candy satisfaction, to appease the frustration of not being able to beat certain parts of the game. But another thing I remember is that I, along with my brothers, or friends who sometimes came over, would repeat some of the voice lines in the game as if they meant something either in our language or even better, our dialect. Once I was connected enough with the real world, either through the internet or by attending some game or game dev related events outside of my home, neighborhood, city, or nation, I realized that many, many other people from all over the world had done a similar thing. Probably not a great epiphany, but I know, but it's something that fascinates me. I loved the last two episodes, and I'm looking forward to listen to the results of your dive into Another World's Black Book. I had always had a harder time trying to read those black books. Thank you, and have a great day, Chris." Well, Chris, oh, first of all, those black books are terribly difficult to read. And, you know, I'm a programmer as well. And I still find them a real challenge to make sense of, even without looking at the source code. But back to your email. Chris, it's so great to have you write in. An Amiga 600 and 1200. Wow. You can imagine how many of us are extremely envious of growing up with two of the finest Amigas out there. I hope your family hung on to them. They're not exactly easy or cheap to find these days. Please let us know if you get a chance. I am overjoyed to hear that you played Another World on its original hardware, just as our Lord Shai hath intended. Oh boy, so do I ever connect with the story about the language from Another World. So here's one of my own. In 2009, I attended my first game developers conference in San Francisco. I was staying at this hostel. I think it was off of Market Street or Market Avenue, just like a block off, with a handful of other grubby kind of non-game developers like myself who very badly wanted to break into the industry. I was a blogger at that time, writing this kind of small unknown blog about game development and the game industry. And I hoped to interview a bunch of interesting people there, which I luckily did. We were all from different places. Two guys were from New York, specifically Brooklyn. I remember one guy being Dan Fish. Dan, if you're out there, I would love to be in contact with you. Another person was from British Columbia. That's in Canada. Another guy was from Austria. And the Austrian guy's name was Oscar. Oscar and I hit it off right away, and we ended up hanging out after the conference. We drove all around the Californian coast together, and we talked pretty much games the entire time. I was talking about how much I loved the animation in this old game I played as a kid, where you play this scientist trapped on an alien planet with your alien buddy. And I didn't say any names. I didn't go into any more description. Oscar took one look at me, and he turned over and said, "Matsuba, this game is universal." I think that's a great epiphany. I haven't thought about that in like almost 15 years. Given that I'm going to be covering just the development history today, we're going to have a fourth and fifth part of the Another World series. So, everyone else, please do write in if you've got any Another World stories or just want to comment on the game in general. Did you like it? Did you think it was terrible? Did you actually finish it? Because that in itself can be quite the cause. If you want to talk about anything else related to the show, the address here is vga@vga256.com. Okay, so time for an inventory check. Now, I know I promised my wife that the Mac Plus was going to be the last kind of retro computing purchase for a while. Keep it kind of reduced. But I couldn't resist this Tandy PC that came up for sale recently. But, oh, I can already hear your voice, Ben. VGA, don't you already have a Tandy 1000? Well, yes, technically I do. But this isn't just any Tandy I picked up. The older Tandy I've got is a Tandy 1000 TL2. That's a 286 with 640K of RAM, of which only 512K is usable because, like I said in the last episode, 128K is given over to the video card for VRAM. This machine that came up for sale is a much newer, newer for 1989. Tandy 2500 386 SX25 with, I think it came with 2 megs of RAM on board. Yes, Tandy's model lineup managed to somehow get past the 1000 into dangerous and, you know, shocking places. While this new Tandy is a desktop model as well, the body, the form factor has changed a little bit. It's slimmer, it's less bulky, and it's fitted with an outer plastic case over a metal shell, kind of exoskeleton, that something like the Dell would have a few years later, actually many years later. It took almost 10 years for Dell to get to that point. The older Tandy, the TL2, actually has can hear that, a big, serious, heavy IBM XT-like outer case that you could kill an ox with. So this new machine is outfitted with a single 1.44 meg high-density floppy drive, but it has space for a 5 1/4 inch expansion bay and four, I wrote down four, but I know it's three 16-bit ISA cards. The machine came factory with an 80 meg Western Digital IDE drive, and I think it cost about $1,500 US for the machine in 1991, which is actually a real bargain after adjusting, you know, even after you adjust for inflation. Considering a 386 in 1991 for under $2,000 is pretty good. The machine was bone stock when I received it, and it clearly had never really been used since it was manufactured. The case screws were, you know, how when you torque on a screw and it kind of makes a popping noise when you remove the screw, that's the exact noise those screws made when I removed them, when I opened up the case. So it was great to hear that kind of torque pop sound. There was not a speck of dust inside the machine, and it sure looks like the machine had never been opened in its lifetime. I bought it for $100, and that included a 13-inch VGA monitor, kind of this no-name high dot pitch VGA monitor. The trend these days is to buy these ultra high scan rate VGA monitors that can output like 1920 by 1200 and or by 1600, some, you know, crazy 4:3 aspect ratios, high res at 100, you know, hertz. I'm actually not into that. I like really chunky dot pitch monitors, because when the dots get kind of big, it tends to blend, in my opinion at least. I think it actually does a better job of blending hard pixel art rasterized bitmaps. And it just looks a little bit more ancient. So anyway, it was great meeting the seller. He was a fellow MS-DOS and Mac enthusiast. And he mentioned, I'll get on to that in a little bit. Why am I so excited about this particular machine? Well, partly because it's a 386. I've never owned a real 386 before, ever. My family jumped directly from the Tandy TRS-80, and we also had a Mattel Intellivision at the time, but that doesn't really count, does it? To an Amstrad XT 8 megahertz, to an IBM PS1 486 SX33. Yeah, from an XT, you know, 8088, I think, or is that an 8086? I think that's an 8088 to a 8486. That's four generations. That's massive. All of those jumps were pretty serious jumps in architecture and speed. So we ended up missing the 386 and 286 era completely. That came at a cost, though. I was always interested in retro computing, even at a young age, and I found myself trying to play older games like Wing Commander on our brand spanking new 486. As I later found out, they were written without any kind of frame rate limiting or internal timer, so games like Wing Commander at, you know, 100 frames per second on a 486 was pretty much unplayable. A program called Moslow, or Moslow, as some people say, wouldn't come out for several years. And the turbo button, most people think the turbo button does something like, oh, it slows down your computer 50% or 25%. No, the turbo button drops your processor down into an XT compatibility mode, which is 8 megahertz. So hitting the turbo button to play something like Wing Commander is useless, because Wing Commander is supposed to be run on like a 12 megahertz machine, so you'll end up getting terrible frame rates. There's just no really good in between. So I was always interested in playing retro stuff, even when we had, you know, what would be considered a retro computer. The 386 SX25 I just picked up is a pretty ideal machine for games that came out in 1990 through, oh, I don't know, 93? Before a 486 with 8 megs of RAM became the standard in the mid-90s. I remember listening to Joe Mastriani saying that Joe ran the Upper Memory Block podcast, and you know, Joe mentions in many, many episodes, I've been re-listening to it, it's so wonderful, that his 486 DX266 was his favorite machine of all time. And I can understand why. Because if you played games around 1994, 95, like Crusader No Remorse, Wing Commander 3, it could do it all. It was the most ubiquitous 486 of its time. Our little chintzy SX33, it wrapped it around a pole. It was such a slow machine in comparison to that DX266 that had the built-in math coprocessor. So have been dreaming, and I've been trying to build this for the last couple of years, the ultimate Ultima 7 machine. This is a machine that can play Ultima 7 as it was originally intended. Ultima 7 is another one of those games which does not have proper frame rate limiting. It does have an internal timer of a sorts, because I know, like, for instance, the game will not run at 1,000 megahertz. It just won't. It'll top out at some top speed where it seems to just run really fast, but not so fast it's unplayable. I noticed, you know, DX266 seems to be its kind of limit of the fastest you'll ever want to run it on, because NPCs walk around way too quickly. The machine that I think it was developed on and for was a 386 SX25. I think that was kind of the state-of-the-art machine at the time that they were building this game on. I don't have any evidence of this other than the fact that it was, I think they recommended a 386 SX16 as it's set up. So it tells me a 25 was probably what it was developed on. So I've got it now. I can finally do it. Well, what am I going to do with the rest of the machine? Upgrades-wise, keep in mind this machine came bone stock, had no sound card. I stuck a Sound Blaster Pro 2.0 in there. I may switch that out in the future, because there's all of this complicated, annoying stuff about MPU 401 compatibility. There is UART mode. I'm not even how I call it UART mode, UART mode. And then there's intelligent MPU 401 mode. Some games support one over the other. I believe Ultima 7 is a UART mode game. I don't know what the Sound Blaster Pro 2.0 supports. I haven't tried this out yet. So I'm going to play around and with different sound cards, going to see what is kind of the ubiquitous card that would fit well in this, that also allows me to hook it up to my MT32, because Ultima 7 with an MT32 is a completely different game than it is with a Sound Blaster. I am in a little bit of a conundrum, however, because the machine has room for a single 5.25-inch disk drive. What do I put in? Do I put in a double speed CD-ROM drive that I can hook up to the IDE port on the Sound Blaster? Do I put in a high density 5.25-inch drive so I have compatibility with both kind of late 80s games that are run on low density and early 90s games that also got released on 5.25-inch high density, like King's Quest V, I believe. What would you have done? Write in, I would love to know. Keep in mind that my goal is always to create historically accurate builds. I'm never too interested about in how accessible or convenient the build is. Aside from one thing, I do get rid of the hard drives in these and replace them with an IDE to SD controller. That's simply because the amount of noise that those drives make once the spindles start to lose their lubrication. Mac stores are incredibly bad for this, or quantum fireballs. Wow, they scream. It's this high-pitched squeal you'll get from the machine. And it doesn't sound bad for the first 5 minutes, but wow, try playing this for more than 20 minutes and you will descend into Cthulhu-like madness. I'm not worried about how convenient it is. I just want to create something historically accurate. So how would you have connected it? Would you have put in a CD-ROM drive or a high density floppy drive in 91? Would you have had an external CD-ROM via the parallel port, or remove the 5.25-inch drive completely? I'd love to hear your thoughts, because this is fun for me. Now, keep in mind, I personally did not get a CD-ROM until 1994, so that's 3 years after this machine was on sale. So it seems likely to me that this was probably a candidate for a 5.25-inch drive, but I'd love to hear from you and hear what you think. Now, going back to the DOS and Mac enthusiast who sold me the Tandy 1000. Well, he emailed me last week, letting me know that he planned on selling his Macintosh LC475. What do I do? Especially considering that I made a promise several weeks ago to my wife that the Mac Plus was going to be the last retro computing purchase on my on my list. Well, yeah, that was a week ago when I started writing these notes. A few days ago, I went and picked up the LC-475 from him. What am I, Superman? Somebody offers to sell me a cheap Mac, of course I'm going to buy it. And the LC-475 is one of the coolest machines. It looks, to me at least, like the natural progression from the next step, next station, which is this, we call it a pizza box or slab, a next slab. It's a pizza box shaped and sized form factor case, and it came with a 14-inch monitor. What is there to say no for $100 there? say no to. I did not say no to that. I bought it, and it was the exact machine, as it turns out, that I used in my high school in 1994 was the year that my high school got these, probably on a grant from the government to buy cheap apples. We got an entire lab of these LC-475s, all color, which is really cool because the only Macs I had saw prior to that were all black and white Mac Pluses, as well as with those, they put 25 of these LC-475s in our Mac lab. And then they also gave us what was called the AV Mac, which I think was some sort of a Quadra, I believe, or maybe a Power Mac. I'm not really sure. No, it was a Quadra. It was a Quadra that actually had video input, which was super cool. You could actually transfer VHS tapes to the machine. Anyway, this LC-475, we played the heck out of a program called Mac Bolo, a networked tank game where you drive these little tanks around on a map, which you could also modify the map in real time. Was it in real time? No, you could blow up stuff on the map in real time, but it came with a map editor that you could share maps with other players and play up to 16 players. So yeah, imagine a 16-player multiplayer game in 1994. It blew us away. I also played a game called Lunatic Fringe, which came, that was like a game based on a game called Continuum, that was, included in the After Dark screensaver, for the Mac. I absolutely loved it. This LC-475 is going to get a lot of love, but first I actually have to pry out that ugly old SCSI, hard drive inside and replace, I think it's got like a 2 gigabyte SCSI drive, replace that with a SCSI 2 SD or possibly a blue SCSI, and then I will have a dead silent Mac once again. Now, software-wise, I finally got a copy of The Shadow of Eusebius. That's the little-known RPG that Sierra made specifically for the Imagination Network and or the Sierra Network. The fascinating thing about this game is that while it was built for multiplayer, that means a few players could get together over 2400 baud and yourself, and you could go adventuring in a little kind of dungeon-crawling group, they did re-release this as a single player experience in a big box. In fact, it's both the original game, Shadow of Eusebius, and its sequel, The Fates of Twinion, on two different sets of diskettes. There is an excellent and well-written manual, which is surprisingly thick for Sierra. Think more like a Quest for Glory manual, kind of those School for Adventurers style manuals. And of course, the requisite 5 hours of free time with the Sierra Network, which never turns out to be free, disc included inside. I'm very excited to play this, and I'd love to hear if any of you are familiar with this game in its single-player form or the Imagination Network in general. That's something that I will want to cover that in a future episode, because I'm looking right over here on my shelf at a copy of the Imagination Network. This is it's a little suitcase. They actually designed the box as a little miniature suitcase with stickers all over it, as if this went through like a 1970s airport. And there's a bunch of stuff inside. It's sealed, and I'm probably not going to open it, but I would love to do an episode on the Imagination Network and talk about that online service. So, without further ado, let's explore the multi-year development history of Another World. This development history is broken up into two parts. This first part is titled The Origins and Early Ludography of Eric Chailly. As you can already anticipate, another world has its origins in the mind of a single man, Eric Chahi, born in October 21st of 1967. So he is a little older than I thought he was. In the town of Yeres, I apologize if I don't pronounce any of these words in French properly, just so you know, while my family is part Quebecois, my pronunciation is usually of the Quebecois style, and that often doesn't translate too well into Parisian. So I will do my best. Yeres, I'm guessing is the way you pronounce that, is part of this kind of sub-department of Paris called Essonne in the region of l'Île-de-France, which lies about 20 kilometers northeast of central Paris. So just imagine a straight kind of straight line shot 20 kilometers to the northeast. That's where you'll find Yeres. In the late 60s, microcomputers and moreover personal computers just weren't around. So it was a happy accident that, just as Chahi entered his teenage years, that microcomputers like the Apple II, the BBC Micro, and the Sinclair ZX Spectrum started to spread through Western Europe. The young Chahi's first experience with a microcomputer was on the venerable Sinclair ZX81, found at his high school at the time. I'm guessing this would probably be the mid-1970s. His time with the machine was short. He practiced programming BASIC on it only for a few months before he acquired his first family computer, the UK-based Tangerine Computer Systems ORIC 1. The first few months with the ORIC were spent learning ORIC BASIC and culminated in his first published game, Frog or Grenouille, written in ORIC BASIC. Frog is an arcade game in which you play a frog whose energy or food bar just kind of decreases continually, and the only way to survive is to keep catching flies with your tongue. So imagine kind of like a top-down thing where you've got flies on one side, you're with the frog on the other side. If you accidentally eat a wasp, the wasp makes you explode. It was published by a little French developer slash publisher, I'm guessing it's probably just a publisher, called ASN Diffusion, in August of 1983, making Chahi just shy of his 16th birthday when he had his first published title. Along with Frog, Chahi also had created Carnaval, which is a shooting gallery type arcade game where you fire your gun located at the bottom of the screen at targets at the top of the screen. In a bit of a twist to that, the targets gradually descend to the bottom of the screen, just like Space Invaders, and when they get to the bottom, you get kind of squashed or killed, and that's the end of your gun. According to Chahi, despite the colorful pixel art and fast-paced gameplay, Carnaval and Frog sold terribly, and very few copies actually ever made it into players' hands. The publisher, ASN Diffusion, didn't even give him his own copy out of courtesy. Years later, while at a fun fair, which I imagine is some sort of town fair or carnival itself, he actually found a copy of Carnaval in a box of cassette tapes that were for sale and bought it for himself. The tape itself is adorable. The owner, the original owner, actually obviously a five-year-old child, drew a duck and a rabbit on the front in marker along with the words, 2400 baud. Despite the poor sales, Chahi was not deterred, and he continued programming for the next year, still in ORIC BASIC, and created actually a verb and noun parser combined with a graphical window above. Seeing it now, considering this is 1985, is fairly impressive. Considering that, especially only a few years earlier, Ken and Roberta Williams had released the high-res adventures series of games like Mystery House. So in that time frame, he releases what I consider to be actually a more visually pleasing game than what Sierra was releasing at the time, Le Sceptre de Anubis, as was the rage in the early 1980s after the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun in the 1920s. Chahi continued in that tradition to make a fantasy game about a player exploring as an archaeologist in an Egyptian pyramid for the scepter of Anubis. While a verb and noun parser-based game was kind of standard fare for players in the mid-1980s, Shai notices that due to the limitation of the architecture and Auric Basic, progression through Le Sceptre d'Anubis was painfully difficult. Worse, he had added a bunch of instant and unpredictable death traps throughout the pyramid that surely frustrated players. I wonder where he might do that again, but I'm anticipating our story. While the verb and noun parser was not a major advancement in itself, the vector-based drawing system that the game used for its rooms, all shown in the first person like Ultima 1, was quite impressive. Shai notes that the memory limitations of the Auric 1, which was about 48K when it was fully outfitted, although I think it might have been released with 12K originally, made bitmapped graphics an impossibility. So he actually created a vector-based drawing program to create pictures based on straight lines. Since there was no mouse to do this, and he didn't have access to a digitizing tablet like the Williams used, drawing a room involved moving a cursor around the screen with the arrow keys on the keyboard until he found the right spot, then hitting return to register a new point on the line, and then continuing. You can imagine how painfully slow this process was. This is something Shai would correct years later, as we will find out. Now, thinking more historically, at the time, French publisher Logiciel, a play on logiciel, that means programs, and logiciel has kind of auric in the center of that word, meaning, let's say, games for or programs for the auric. Programs plus auric. It had established itself as the premier publisher of high-quality Auric titles in France. Shai pitched his new game to the publisher, who, shockingly, turned it down. It turned out that the day that Shai pitched his game to Logiciel, a graphical third-person adventure game, far more in the style of King's Quest, had been released, and it wowed audiences. This, of course, would be the famous game L'Aigle d'Or, which is kind of like the Golden Eagle, I think. L'Aigle d'Or would kind of set the standard for what a third-person adventure game would be on the Auric. It turned out that not only was he turned down, but his program looked dated in comparison. Shai remembers 30 years later that the rejection from Logiciel was a hard blow, and it spurred him to find another publisher to publish the game, which he did. So in 1985, the publisher Microprogramme 5, that sounds like Microprogrammes 5, published Le Sceptre d'Anubis, which was kind of a year after it had already been completed. That must have been rough. So despite the rejection from Logiciel, he would take another swing of the bat with a game called Doggy in 1984. In this little arcade game, a little reminiscent of, let's say, Wonder Boy for the Sega Master System or even Excitebike for the NES, you play a dog that must jump over obstacles and make his way back home. Like Wonder Boy, the dog has an energy meter that depletes as you move, and the only way to progress is to eat some kind of raw dog bones found on the road along the way. The game benefited greatly from a new tool in Shai's toolkit, his knowledge of 6502 assembly. Doggy runs fast compared to his previous work on Frog and Carnival. While there is some video flicker when you see several objects on the same raster lines, and this would be typical of something like an NES game, or Sega Master System game as well, it is a far more visually impressive game than its previous releases, and it received a warm welcome at Logiciel with a good marketing push. Shai notes that this was his first experience with animation on a computer, and this would be a theme that would continue for the next 15 years. At the end of 1984 and the beginning of 1985, Shai made a change in architecture. The Auric 1's heady days were kind of over, and 48K was proving to be a real liability. it was replaced by an Amstrad CPC 464. Now, it's unclear to me what the motivation for moving to the CPC 464 was. Comparing the Auric 1 and the CPC side by side, I don't actually see a tremendous difference in capabilities. Graphically, the Auric 1 used a strange mixed mode resolution that allowed for both raster-based pixels on the screen, as well as a few lines of text at the bottom. Imagine kind of a split screen where you've got the top with raster-based pixel art, the bottom just with text. Pretty much what you'd need to make actually a decent graphical parser-based adventure game. The upper part of the screen ran at 240 pixels by 200 with 8 simultaneous colors, and I think there were about 3 or 4 lines of text at the bottom that would take up the remaining pixels. Not pixels, characters. On the CPC 464, it actually had a few different graphical modes. It had a 160 by 200 mode with 16 colors, a 320 by 200 mode with 4 colors, and a 620 by 200 mode in monochrome. Going back to the Auric 1 came with a standard MOS 6502 processor running 1 megahertz, which is more or less the standard of off-the-shelf 6502 that you'd find in many other machines of its time, like the Apple II. The CPC 464 went with the competing Zilog Z80 running at 4 megahertz, which you might say, wow, 4 times faster than a 6502. Unfortunately, the Z80 relied upon a much larger instruction set to accomplish certain tasks, and in the end, the 6502 actually ran 3 to 4 times faster than the Zilog at the same clock speed. So, when you compare a 4 MHz Zilog Z80 and a 1 MHz MOS 6502 with a comparable set of instructions, the outcome was usually a wash. The Z80 might be slightly faster for certain tasks. But there was maybe one thing that the CPC 464 had in its dugout that the other team didn't have on the Auric 1. It came with a standard of 64K of RAM compared to the measly 16 or outfitted fully 48K available to the Auric 1. These cramped memory limitations had impressed themselves upon Chailly, especially during the development of Le Sceptre d'Ennui, and this alone, thinking as a programmer, might be what pushed him over the edge into getting the Amstrad CPC. I am just guessing here. It's fully possible that he just had his Auric 1 break down and he had to replace it with something else. This is pure speculation. So the question is, what difference did a new architecture make for Chailly's next game? His first published CPC 464 project would be Infernal Runner in 1985. If that name rings a bell to you, it's because Infernal Runner was originally a Commodore 64 game made by Yves Corta and Michael Coel for Le Riciel that same year. I imagine that, given how small the French game development scene is at the time, Chailly likely probably both knew Corta and Coel and ported it to the 464 for Le Riciel, according to Chailly. He even did it for free. So I'm guessing this was kind of a buddy porting another buddy's game kind of situation. Infernal Runner reminds me of a combination of the platformer Dark Castle for the Macintosh, Jet Set Willy, and maybe Prince of Persia all mashed together. You traverse large levels going from left to right, avoiding pits and traps and enemies while swinging across hazards with overhead ropes, kind of like Pitfall, jumping across chasms, and all the while collecting treasures. It's well loved by its fans, despite not being really known outside of Europe, just due to the fact that it wasn't published elsewhere. Chailly's port of Infernal Runner to the 464, as ports often do, would both gain and lose a few things along the way. The Commodore 64's really dynamic soundtrack for the game that relied upon the SID chip would be replaced by a new soundtrack by Mikhail Winogradov, apologize, Mikhail, Which, although not technically as impressive as the C64 version, was still enjoyable to listen to. Keep in mind that the Amstrad CPC just had kind of a beepy boopy kind of a speaker to it. It didn't have a full SID chip like the Commodore 64. Animation-wise, the animation would improve slightly, as would the resolution, owing to the CPC-464's different video chipset. Because the game only had four colors in each room, Shai would opt for an ultra-bright palette with tons of contrast. The Commodore 64 version was flicker-free, but the CPC-464 version definitely has flicker on every other frame, which really does honestly detract from the experience. And that's something Shai himself notes, and he says, you know, once I realized I could actually fix this problem, I would do that in later games. In all, we can say that this was a solid first port for someone who had just switched over to a new architecture and was no worse than any other port of its time. Comparing Doggy to his next 464 game, Infernal Runner, shows off just how Shai was beginning to master the confines of a limited color palette. Infernal Runner retains that bright, colorful, high contrast style, and realism is always sacrificed for readability on the screen. Moving on to the next year, as Shai had done once before, his arcade game was followed up by an adventure game. This time he set his sights on the 1979 film The Amityville Horror. Like Le Sceptre d'Anubis, his new Amstrad CPC game Le Pacte, published by Loriciel in 1986 actually, would be a standard parser plus graphical adventure for its time, like Sierra Online's first-person adventures, of course, with much better graphics by this point. Shai says that his goal was to build an atmospheric horror game that related the sense of dread by making the house the central character of the game. He writes, "I wish to create a truly oppressive climate. It was the first game where I sought to make the player feel something, to communicate an emotion to the player. Creatively, this was an important stage for me." Again, Shai would take a crack at writing another verb plus noun parser for the game, this time allowing the player to select between two lists for each word. Unfortunately, the lists were not context sensitive, so you'd have to laboriously scroll through the same dozens of words each time to find the right first word on the left for the specific room you were in. Then move to the second list, scroll down that through that list to find the second, you know, the noun in the list. And so this would take about a minute to do each time. And often the words you chose had no specific application in the room you were in. And you'd get kind of a meaningless, try again error, or that doesn't do anything error. And you'd start scrolling through the two lists again at, 2 minutes a pop. Oh boy, does that get tiresome. It's not hard to imagine how frustrating that was to progress through the game in this fashion, especially if you are a guess and test type player as I am. The game was, though, not without its charms. Shai notes that its use of a day and night cycle for outdoor areas was particularly unique at the time. Given that this is 1986, I think it's fair to say that, at least for us in North America, day and night cycles used to create immersion was a fairly new thing. In fact, in my experience, the only time I saw a day and night cycle used was several years later in King's Quest IV. Another notable thing was that the game featured a Polaroid camera mechanic that was sensitive to the occult forces. The camera would let you scan the room, and if you took a photograph of a previously invisible demon that would become visible once you took a photo of it, it would now appear on screen, which would allow you to destroy it. So the Polaroid camera was there both to reveal the demon as well as dispose of it. And finally, I can't help but notice just how gorgeous the box art is for Le Pacte. This is one of the very few times I can say that an early cassette tape's case art is stunning. Normally, cassette tapes do not have great case art in this time. This is just my opinion now. They're often these kind of poorly illustrated fantasy art kind of pieces. This is a great piece of graphic design. The cover is all black, but in bright red raised or embossed lettering, the words Le Pacte are scrawled in blood. There are no screenshots or illustrations of any kind, and it actually really reminds me of the Ultima 7 The Black Gate cover, which is kind of this monolithic black box. It's a shame that the game sold poorly, and I would love to have my own copy despite not owning an Amstrad CPC. After Le Pacte, so this would probably be late 1986, early 1987, Chailly would spend the next 2 years working as an in-house graphic designer for French publisher Chips. Chailly said that for these couple of years, he built one unfinished prototype after another, not as graphic designer, but, you know, on his own personal projects. Each of these prototypes was all too ambitious and they could never be completed. Boy, do I ever know what that's like. Meanwhile, the graphic design he did for other Chips games served to pay the bills. Most of these games and projects seem to be, and I'm talking about the games that Chailly was working on for Chips, tried to squeeze the last bit of life out of the CPC before it was replaced in 1988 with an incredible new machine, the Amiga. Chailly's transition to the Amiga, to me at least, is a watershed moment between what I think of as Chailly's early work and his later work that would come to define him as one of the French developers, let's say the top three French developers of the 1980s and 1990s. That transition wasn't as immediate as I'm implying, but without the Amiga, I don't think Chailly's games would have matured quite the way that they did. Most notably, Voyage au Centre de la Terre, that's Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, received an interesting sequel of a sorts for the Atari ST and Amiga. The artwork for this game is notably digitized photographs with light paint overs, along with some pseudo-realistic running animation for the main character. In this game, there's actually one minigame that has boulders falling in the foreground as the protagonist tries to run past them in a side-scroller kind of experience that I can honestly say is 100% directly used in another world. It was shocking to see. I've never seen anybody mention this before because I guess a lot of people did not play this particular game of Chailly's. While Chailly would solely paint in the game and he did not do any programming, it would introduce him to programmer Daniel Moret, a name we'd see a lot more in future Chailly projects. A year later, in 1988, Chips would publish Jeanne d'Arc, Joan of Arc, for the Atari ST and the Amiga, followed by a similar, you know, this game would be also in the same similar mini game plus story format that they used in Voyage au Centre de la Terre. Instead of moving through the story chapter by chapter, this game would be composed of several war mini games, kind of strategy-like mini games, separated by an overhead map scenario where you would choose which territory to invade next. I'm thinking of something like Syndicate, if you remember how progression works in Syndicate. Players found the game challenging and charming, and I think it might be the best remembered game from Chailly's days at Chips as a graphic designer. The artwork features some really nicely dithered backgrounds, and the scanned photograph realism of Voyage is replaced by some more painterly hand-painted work. Now, for the watershed moment. This is when, at least to me, Chailly appears on the map as one of the leading developers in French history. In 1989, Chailly took up some contract work from newly incorporated French developer Delphine with none other than project leader Paul Cuisset, whom we discussed at length in the flashback episodes. The new project, Les Voyageurs de Temps in France, later renamed as Future Wars, Time Travelers in Europe, or just Future Wars, Adventures in Time in North America, was about a skyscraper window cleaner who discovers a time machine and some alien documents which lead him on a cross-time chase between the 14th century, the 44th century, and the Cretaceous time period to prevent an alien invasion. I think that this game most definitely deserves an entire podcast episode or two of its own, so I won't go into tremendous detail here. I did talk a little bit about it in the flashback episode, so if you want a little bit more information on that game, please go back to the flashback episodes. Shai gets the only art credit on the entire game, which to me is a feat, considering that this is a point-and-click adventure game with complex backgrounds, character sprites, and animation. If you remember back to our flashback episodes, Future Wars is where Kwisei and his entire team developed the cinematique engine that would be used in future games by Delphin. Shai's art in Future Wars is delightful. The shot of the window cleaner standing on his hanging platform in front of a mirrored glass skyscraper is stunning. There's a calm, compressed palette to many of these backgrounds, which are all hand-painted this time instead of being photographic paint-overs. And furthermore, there's just a nice mix of backgrounds, indoor and outdoor, that prevent the game from feeling too claustrophobic. And when I say that, I'm thinking of games that are mostly composed of, like, say, office spaces, square box rooms, hardly angular stuff. This is a great mix. There is a little bit of that, but mostly they're outdoor scenes, cavern scenes in very, you know, large cathedrals that go on, that kind of disappear into the background. I would say, though, more than anything else in this game, what stands out to me with his artwork is the use of silhouettes and monochromatic palettes. For instance, there's a scene of Earth in 4315 AD after some kind of devastation, let's say a world war. The scene looks to be painted in about six colors, all various shades of orange. In the foreground are these crumbling walls of old buildings. In the mid-plane, you see broken pieces of concrete. And then there are several levels of deep background, all using lighter and lighter shades of orange to communicate distance, kind of distance fog. It feels huge, empty, and alone. This artistic styling would, to me, come to define another world in the very short future. Moreover, the box art, which is this extreme close-up of the window washer sneakers in front of mirrored glass, which is the buildings he's standing in front of at the start of the game, appears to actually be painted by Shai himself. Now, I'm guessing this because Shai later allowed a new black and white print to be made of the same artwork, so I'm guessing he was the original artist and granted that to another artist to repaint. Now, she would have etched this. Anyway, Shai would spend about a year or a year and a half on Future Wars, making this almost a three-year stretch where he had not programmed his own games and focused solely on art and animation. Although he was able to express himself artistically in this contract work he was doing for Delphin, ultimately, he was working with other people's ideas, and this started to nag at Shai. This would all change when Shai saw the Amiga release of Dragon's Lair. I imagine that most people who listen to this podcast will have at least heard of this game. But in case you haven't seen it in its various versions, the original was hand-painted animation cells that were traditionally animated and then filmed frame by frame and transferred to Laserdisc. As you can imagine, this was a huge amount of data for 24 frames per second of animating on twos and threes. That is, when you animate on twos, you are putting 12 frames of animation, you know, you're painting every other frame for every 24 frames of animation, a film. And if you animate on threes, that's 8, 16, 24? Yeah. Animating on threes gives you 8 frames for every 24 frames of film, that is each second of animation, respectively. This was the early 1980s. That kind of full-screen, full-motion video had never been seen in an arcade before. Well, this is now 1990. I think Dragon's Lair was originally around 1983, I want to say, in the arcade. This is 1990, many years later after its original release. Dragon's Lair was finally ported to the Amiga. Although it took up six diskettes, the animation in Dragon's Lair blew Xiaoyi away. It was smooth, it was colorful, and it was ultimately pretty faithful to the original game. But the issue of disk space was a problem. Although large bitmapped animations with very few colors, think of Dirk the Daring, you know, he only needs to be animated in four colors with lots of big open spaces in his chest, in his helmet, that kind of thing. This compresses really, really well. But it still means a ton of disk space, even after compression. And now think about animating this in 5 or 10 frames per second. You've got a lot of disks. Xiaoyi realized that instead of painting these as bitmaps, as the artist had originally done, and then compressing the heck out of them and decompressing on the fly from disk, he could redefine the same animations as vectors. Vectors could include instructions like fill, which is a paint bucket, or draw a line here, or draw a circle here, instead of having to specify each and every pixel per frame of animation. You might lose a little bit of definition with each frame, yes, but after all, you know, after all, you're working with linear or curvilinear mathematical relationships to define a line or a circle. But instead of a single frame of animation taking up 5 to 10 kilobytes, you might get that down to, I don't know, half a kilobyte or less. How would an Amiga or a Atari ST perform running these mathematical calculations to print graphics to the screen instead of decompressing sprites? Well, that's a question we'll have to answer next week. I didn't think I'd have to split the history section of Another World into two different parts, but this episode's getting a little long, and I think this is a great place to split it up, because next week we will talk about the actual development history of Another World. This will be the second part of the development history. So thank you, my friends, for being patient and kind of loping along with me as I figure out how to tell the story of Another World. It has been quite a journey so far. I look forward to seeing you again in about a week. You know, sometimes it's 10 days. It depends on how long it takes to write these episodes. Fortunately, I have some great source of material to draw from. Xiaoyi, you know, wrote a diary, not a diary. He wrote a reflection of what his work was like back in those days that I can draw from quite heavily. And he's got some scattered interviews over the last few decades about how the development of Another World went. And we will get into the weeds with this next week. I will talk to you again soon. Take care. Finally, a personal note to listeners. When I recorded the first episode of this podcast way back in 2018, I was starting to write a book about growing up with computers of the 80s and 90s, modems, bulletin board systems, and even the early internet. It took several years to write it all down, but I managed to weave together over 80 of those stories, many of which I allude to in this podcast, into a novel-length book. It's called Mages and Modems, a childhood well wasted in the golden age of personal computers, games, and internet piracy. The stories are heartwarming, funny, and honestly, sometimes a little embarrassing. I don't ask for donations to keep this podcast running, so if you'd like to support me and see new episodes of the podcast, please head on over to my website at tomotama.com/books. That's tomotama.com/books. And order a copy of Mages and Modems. There you'll find a DRM-free ebook edition and a beautifully printed paperback edition that I actually designed myself. I hope the stories bring back for you some of the warm memories of the DOS, Windows, and Macintosh era that we all love.